This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 287 was recorded on September 2nd, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Logica Funds founder Wayne Himmelsheim joins me as this week's feature interview guest when the topic will be trading the long volatility strategy. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick will present a slide deck which translates a lot of the concepts that Wayne presented into actionable long vol trades that work in today's market.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, let's jump to that S&P 500. We took a couple weeks summer break and ran that special, and really nothing has changed. The market just keeps plugging away on the upside. We're at 45.36 at the time of recording this on the S&P 500. What's your take on these markets?
Patrick, my view is really unchanged from before our summer break. I think we're in the middle of an Austrian crack-up boom, and I think that the market is likely to head higher from here, not because these valuations make sense, but because there's too much easy money chasing around in the system. So I think that this is likely to continue, and I don't see any reason for it to change. But if it did change, boy, we're in an awfully long way up to fall from here.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, which is really, for the last 2 weeks, finally taken a bit of a pause and a break. We were as high as 93.50 on the Dixie, and we've now backed off back to some of the early August lows near the 92 handle. Is that it for the dollar index? What's your take on there?
Well, I think we're still consolidating, same as I've been saying for, I don't know, months and months now. Until we see a closing print below 89.5, or let's say 89 to really, you know, seal the deal, or much higher, well above 93.5, well, we're in a consolidation. That's where we've been, and I don't see any reason to break out of it anytime soon because I think the market is trying to still figure out all of this monetary policy from all around the world and how it's going to conflict with one another and eventually what it results. So I think it's going to stay confused for a long time.
All right, well, let's get to crude oil. I was really curious to get an update from you because when we last were together on this doing a market wrap, oil was on the way down and correcting down to the low 60s. In the last 2 weeks, we've seen a significant reversal. Over the last few days, we consolidated. And then today on that bullish U.S. demand data, we've got a punch above 70, at least temporarily. Is this back to an oil bull market again?
I think that the bull market is continuing. As I've said before, it was put on hold or on pause because everybody was assuming that August was going to be the big month of huge drawdowns on inventory. When that didn't happen, and instead we saw a worsening of the Delta variant, COVID spreading around the world, it just led everybody to start to panic and say, oh my gosh, we could be headed toward negative prices again. The fundamentals are not there for that. I still think we're headed above $80 into the mid-80s. I had said I thought that was going to happen by Labor Day. Obviously, it's not going to happen by Labor Day. I still think it'll happen before year end that we'll be trading over 80. As far as inventory this week, we had seen the market sell off before inventory, probably on expectations that Saudi Arabia and the rest of OPEC Plus was going to do exactly what they were expected to do and what they did do, which was to go ahead with their increase in production starting next month. That had the market down a bit, and of course, it bounced right back up when we saw a fairly significant drawdown of 7.2 million barrels drawn down on crude oil in the United States. Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 836,000 barrels. Gasoline building 1.3 million. Distillates drawing down 1.7 million barrels. Meanwhile, U.S. production ticking up again to 11.5 million barrels. That's a pretty significant increase, starting to look like a trend there, and it's in the opposite direction from what some people had anticipated. So it looks like, at least on the U.S. production side, that's a little bit of slightly bearish data. But the rest of what we're seeing is pretty bullish, and I think that we're still headed above 80 eventually.
All right, well, let's touch on gold, because obviously we had that washout in that first week of August. But really, gold recovered right back into that trade range where it was through much of July, hovering just, you know, around the 1800 level, give or take. We're closing around 1810, or at least trading around 1810 at the time of recording. What's your take here on gold?
Well, I think you're right that it's back to where we were, but back to where we were is stuck underneath the long-term moving averages. We've got the 100 and 200-day moving averages almost co-located now between 1815 and 1819 or so. So what we really need here, Patrick, is a daily close over 1820 and for it to stay there for several days. That would be the green light for the next big move higher. Until we get over this critical resistance, though, Patrick, we're back to where we were in July when we were saying, oh boy, we're sitting right here on this critical line. As soon as we can get over, it'll probably accelerate from there. We ended up going way down instead of up. Now we're back up to where we started. Let's see what happens. But if we can get that breakout above 1820, I think there's a big move ahead.
All right, well, let's touch on that 10-year Treasury yield, because it really does look like bond traders took the summer off. I mean, we were trading basically at 1.30 back in July, and here we are still trading at that same level. And it doesn't seem like the U.S. Treasury bond markets are as they're winding up sideways, but no big trend moves emerging yet. Do you have any intuition as to what's next?
Well, my intuition is that what's next probably doesn't come next or doesn't happen for quite a while. If you look at the history of the bond market, a lot of people want to say, okay, it seems like the bond bull market of the last 35 years is finally over. Okay, well, if you believe it's finally over, that leads a lot of people to jump to the conclusion, well, surely it must be reversing then. So now it's all downhill from here. If you look at what happened after World War II when the bond market bottomed, it stayed bottomed for like 10 years before it eventually started making a march to higher yields. So I think it could be several years that we're stuck here at just above zero interest rates. And frankly, I don't think we're stuck in an interest rate trap. We can't go any higher in interest rates until we inflate away the real value of all of the public and private debt that exists in the system. And that's going to take a long time.
This week's feature interview guest is Logica Funds founder Wayne Himmelsheim. Eric, why did we invite Wayne on the show this week?
Well, Wayne runs a fund that's all about trading the long volatility strategy. And when we had Chris Cole on the show just before the Volmageddon event back in 2018, Chris explained exactly what was wrong and why the short vol trade had the potential to blow up and talked about the benefits of the long vol trade. Ever since then, we've had quite a few listener emails saying, get Chris or somebody else back on to talk more about how you actually put on this long vol trade. So we've got Wayne talking to that subject in today's interview, and then we're going to extend it in the post-game segment when Patrick has a chart deck of his own, which will take a lot of the concepts that Wayne relates and translate them into actionable trading strategies.
Eric's interview with Wayne is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Wayne Himmelsheim, founder of Logica Funds. Wayne has prepared a slide deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Wayne, there's a backstory to how we got you on the show this week. Our listeners were treated way back in the beginning of 2018 in January. We had Chris Cole from Artemis Capital on the show. And I want to refer actually to your slide deck on page 7, because when we had Chris on in January, we were at the top of that big black performance line of this short volatility trade, which had gotten so much attention and frankly suckered a lot of people into taking risks they didn't understand. Chris told us what was about to happen, or what was at risk of happening. And of course, as your chart shows here, that's exactly what happened only a couple of weeks later. Since then, we've had a huge amount of interest in this subject, but we really have a lot of listeners who want to know, how do you put on the long vol trade, and what's the real secret sauce to getting a positive carry when you do that? So Wayne, you're kind of the guy for the long vol fund. Talk to us a little bit about how you see this long vol versus short vol space, and how your views maybe differ from Chris Cole's, which a lot of our listeners are familiar with.
Sure. Yeah. So long vol versus short vol space. I mean, that's just a giant question. And it's a giant question because short vol is really just everywhere. I mean, it's pervasive across all of Wall Street. And so when you say the space, I look at it as like 99% is short vol, and then perhaps 1% of space is long vol, which is, yeah, certainly the contrarian view. And to really highlight the extremes of short vol, there's a great graphic that we have on page 5 of the presentation, which shows the how this is the negative skew across different hedge fund strategies. And so you see that we call it the blood chart. It's the blood chart because everything's red, right? And it just doesn't matter what type of strategy you are. And, you know, the top one is merger arb, has one of the highest negative skews in the industry or across hedge fund styles, at least over that period. It's not totally persistent over time, but certainly over this period, it was merger arb. And you go down the list, there's completely different things, event-driven and multi-strat, relative value. They're all, you know, they all have their pitch books with completely different stories to tell about what they do and how they do it and how they identify cheap versus expensive and all these different facets of each strategy. And yet at the end of the day, they all share the same exposure, which is this negative skew, i.e. their down vol is greater than their up vol. They consistently make little bits of money, and every once in a while have these extreme events where things go really out of whack and get this big downside move or big drawdown that creates this negative skew. So it's like always waiting for this event when you're invested in one of these strategies, which is really all strategies is the way to think about it. And the one last point of looking at this page and this chart of how widespread it is in our industry is, to me, it's almost ironic, is the, let's say, eighth one down is hedge fund index of multi-strat. So multi-strat chose to have a negative 1.2 negative skew, but the point here is, the irony is that it's multi-strat. Like, these are people who get into the business to say, we're going to diversify strategies, right? Their sole job is to build a diversified book. And yet, with all that they're doing, at the end of the day, no matter how diverse their pie chart is, they're still ending up with the same grand exposure to short volatility. And it's just fascinating, right? How much of it there is out there. So when you say the short vol space, it's really, to me, the answer is pretty much everyone, right? So then at the other side, on the other side of the coin, you get this small group of people who say, okay, you know, we're going to battle the world, right? We're going to say, and it's really hard to do. There's all these odds are against you when you're long vol. But the problem being that you don't want to sit with that negative skew. You want the opposite outcome in your book. We want the fact that we want our up vol to be greater than our down vol. It's okay to make little bits along the way, and then every once in a while have a home run. To me, that's a much happier, safer, and pleasant way to live. Is I'm not sleeping at night because the big event might happen tomorrow. I'm going to sleep comfortably because tomorrow I might have the big pop, right? And so it's just almost like philosophically, it's the other side that is a pleasant way to exist. So that's point number one, which is really the two different spaces.
Wayne, actually, where I was headed with this is a lot of people, and I think yourself included, what you just said is, to my thinking, the key phrase here, which is you said, make a little bit and then make a lot when you hit that home run. Well, wait a minute. If I go back to page 7 in your chart deck and I look at the way the short vol strategy works, it's making little bits of money over and over again all the time. And then, of course, it loses really, really hard at the end. We see at the beginning of 2018 on this chart. Well, what that says to me is, okay, short vol was winning, winning, winning. That means long vol was losing, losing, losing. All of a sudden, long vol has its big win. Okay, it sounds like what we're talking about is an insurance policy. In other words, it's a negative carry. I've got to pay money. I've got to lose money to have this in my portfolio. And it pays off the day that something really big happens and the market crashes. And then I get that hedge component. But I got to pay for it. What I think you're advertising, and I know other people are advertising, is you don't have to pay for it. It's a positive carry, even though it's a long vol strategy. And I think that's where the skepticism comes into mind. Wait a minute, how'd you pull that off?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? So how do you pull that off? So before I jump into that answer of how, and give away, of course, a bunch of secret sauce, let me step back for a second, divide out the world of long vol. We were talking before about broadly short vol versus long vol, and I said it's basically 99% of the world versus 1% of the world in long vol. So the bigger irony is that within long vol, within that 1%, there is also a big division where the grand majority of long vol achieves long vol with some use of short vol, right? Because to your point, how do you do that? How do you own insurance and make money? Really, the true answer is you can't, right? It's almost financially, it makes no sense. You can't own pure insurance and have a positive carry. Therefore, you have to introduce something, some source of alpha in your book or potentially short vol exposure that generates the carry to pay for what people might phrase as net long vol, right? So the broad majority of the 1%, the long vol community, infuses a short vol overlay, or not overlay, really piece of their book to generate net long vol. So let me explain that. And generally the way would be through relative value trading, right? And relative value says that whether it's a moneyness spread, which is buying an option at one strike and selling at another strike, I might sell at the money options to buy out of the money options, right? In that case, I'm short some volatility with my at-the-money short, but that premium I'm taking in is paying for my long volatility, which might be, let's say, 20% out of the money. In that case, if the market corrects only 10%, I may not be making money. I may even be losing because I'm short from at-the-money, right? I'm short from the beginning, and I need the market to drop enough where that's going to pass that inflection point, and suddenly my long vol position down at 20% is going to take off and first overtake my short and then start really getting convex where my short just goes away, right? So that risk associated with that short to pay for the long, I'd call that an attachment point risk or a path dependency, where it requires, by definition, a certain magnitude of correction for that long vol to not only kick in to break even, but even to start making money, right? Or to start making real money. So you're great in an event like the COVID meltdown in February, March, because a 30% correction meant if you were short at the money and long out of the money, your short's going to disappear, your long's going to overtake it and make you dramatically more. The problem becomes with smaller corrections. The average correction, quote, in the S&P is said to be around 10%. At that level, you're basically making no money, if not even losing on your, quote, insurance, because you sold some insurance to pay for your real risk insurance. So that's the broad world of I'll call it spread trading. And of course, there's many ways to do it. The one I just described was a moneyness trade, where your strikes are at different levels. There are also many times of spreads. There's, for example, calendar spreads, where it's your long one in January and your short out in December, or whatever it might be, or the inverse of that. It's up the term structure, where you're taking advantage of differences of option pricing along the calendar. There's also one of the ones that I am really not a big fan of is doing shorting something where you take idiosyncratic exposure in one thing to get some broader long volatility in another. Let's say, for example, I shorted some individual names in the S&P and took in those premiums to buy S&P index vol, right? So that could work, but has, again, a path dependency, a basis risk, because what if those things you're short are the ones that end up turning against you? What if, you know, it could be, for example, in COVID, there was the meltdown, but Pfizer did really well, or Zoom did really well. So you could be short the wrong thing, so to speak. And so what you're using to pay for your long insurance has this idiosyncratic risk that ends up hurting you when you're trying to insure. So all of these have their exposures, but all of them together have some form of shorting vol to pay for long vol. Okay, so let's say that that's the world, or that's the 95% of long vol books out there, where they're choosing different varieties of spreads, as I said, whether moneyness, whether calendar, whether individual positions across different asset classes versus others, and therefore being different to each other. I stepped in and I surveyed that world, and I said, you know what? I have a problem with that. I don't like that. It's really troubling to me that one thinks it's okay to sell insurance if you're offering insurance, right? It's like, imagine you're, you know, you have car insurance and you get hit and you go make the claim and the insurance company says, well, you know what? You were on the freeway. We only cover side streets, right? That's not acceptable, right? If you're in the business of insurance, you want to insure no matter what happens. You want the most path independence, right? You don't want any form of event to not cover you, whether the market only corrects 10% or whether the market correction doesn't include a certain basket of names or of assets. So I looked at this and I thought to myself, you know, there's an analogy I love to use, which is that the problem with getting short in order to pay for long is I call counter thesis, right? It's counter thesis because as a long vol manager, you're saying, I'm going to provide this long vol. I'm going to provide this convexity. And if you go short vol somewhere else to pay for that, then literally you're taking on a counter thesis trade. It's like analogously, you're saying, I want to do the high jump, so I'm going to go put on a weight belt, right? You don't put on a weight belt to do the high jump. You take off the weight belt. And in fact, you take everything out of your pockets, because your goal is to jump as high as you can. That's convexity, right? That's long vol. So I understood that, or I at least spent some time grasping how what that meant to me and how problematic all of these short vol trades were in long vol books. And I said to myself, I've got to find a way to not do that. How can I not have any short vol exposure in order to be long vol? And the problem is that's very, very difficult. But however, I came upon, in thinking through this, my background started at a trading desk. And so I was around traders and I traded myself. I've traded myself for 25 years. So I know trading. And I'm in concept, trading has a short vol component, but without short vol risk. And let me explain that for a second. Is when you let's say trading is conceptually, right? What is a trade? Is to buy low, sell high, right? That's if you're a good trader, you consistently buy low, sell high. And let's put that on a ticker. Let's say you're trading S&P, right? So you buy S&P on a dip and it runs up and you sell some. In that example, I buy S&P at some level and I sell at some level higher, let's say 5 points higher. When I've sold some of my inventory, my position, I'm selling stock. So it's the same thing as shorting because I'm selling. But in this case, I'm shorting selling some of my inventory. I'm not selling naked, right? I'm not selling inventory I don't have. Therefore, I'm not short. But I'm doing the same thing as a short vol trade because I'm taking off. I'm going against the grain. The market's going up. I bought it at some level. It's starting to run up. And I'm not holding my position for the market to continue gaining, which would be a long vol trade. I'm taking off inventory to reduce that position. Therefore, I'm going against the grain of, quote, the momentum of the market. In that case, by literally selling inventory I own, I'm doing the equivalent of shorting vol, right? Except at the end of the day, I'm not short vol. I've still got only long inventory, just less of it. So that idea struck me as a way to achieve long vol, or rather a way to pay for long vol with some embedded short vol exposure, but without literal short vol, right? So now let's take this through a specific example. If one, let's say, wants to buy puts on the S&P 500, right? So naive put ownership would say, let's buy some puts today and hold them for whatever, 6 months. And so now you have your put position, you have pure insurance, and all you see is it decaying, i.e. the opposite of the chart we're looking at on page 7, right? It's decaying, and then if there's an event in the S&P, that pops up. Okay, that's the naive position. Now I want to infuse my short vol through trading onto that put option. So on Monday, I come in and I see puts are relatively cheap using our models, right? So we say, okay, let's buy 100 puts. Now on Tuesday, you come into the market and there's a little bit of a spike. Puts jump up. I bought them, let's say, at $1 and they jump up to $1.20. Well, great. I'm up a little bit on my puts. I have an inventory of 100. So I sell 10 of them. I end the day with 90. Great. Come in the next day, there's a little bit more of a put spike because the S&P is down again that day. And I sell another 20. I'm left with 70 at the end of the day. By the fourth day or third day, whatever it is, you come in the next day. And now the S&P bounces, right? It goes down a few days and it has a rally and vol crushes a little bit. It gives back. So now I'm only in 70. I can now go and buy back those 30 I sold at $1.20 and $1.30, I cannot go buy them back at 90 cents at a cheaper price, right? So now I'm back to my position of 100, but I've scalped some money out of the market. I've made money trading along the way by conceptually shorting vol, but shorting only through selling some of my inventory. So that's a really interesting way. If one could efficiently and cleverly trade the market, scalp the market, one could consistently stay long volatility, but pay for it along the way with the profits derived from that scalping. That's how we set out to do it, and that's what we do. So the other piece of that is that when you're doing that, you're going to say to me, well, or you, I don't know, you might say to me, your next question might be, but the question that immediately strikes me is, well, you've got to have some risk, right? The risk of the shortfall, the spread trades that I described earlier, where one is using some short to pay for long and getting net long, the risk there is the path dependency, is the attachment point. So what is my risk? My risk is that, well, I never have any short. So I've got, I'm always long volatility. I'm 100% long, both net and gross, right? But my risk is that I have less options or less long vol the day I might need it, right? So if that day that I was down to from 100 down to 70, if the next day was the start of the COVID meltdown, well, I'm not in 100, I'm only in 70. So I'm not going to make quite as much when the market then cracks 10, 20, 30%, right? And I am selling each day it's cracking. So I'm monetizing along the way, which means at the end of the event, once the market's down 30%, I haven't made 100% on my long vol. I've only made, let's say, 40% because I've been monetizing as it's cracking so that I can buy back cheaper because my method is modulating my inventory, not shorting. So in that sense, the risk can be that I'm in less than I need to be. At the same time, I could have a lucky event where vol gets cheaper. And instead of 100, I buy another 20, another 20. I'm in 140 puts. I'm over my necessary number because I'm buying it more cheaply. And then the event happens that day. So instead of making 100% like I would in my 100 inventory of puts, I make 130%, right? So that's the lucky outcome. The point is that I have a probabilistic or a probability rather around having more or less on the day I need it. So if you put that in a little kind of grid of outcomes, I could have the right amount. I could have 100 and everything's good. I could have less than 100 and I make less, and I could have more than 100 and I make more. So what is somebody suffering with me? They're suffering uncertainty around the magnitude of my payoff, depending on how much inventory I have the day of, let's say, Black Monday, right? And so to me, that is a worthwhile risk. That is a very worthwhile risk because no matter what, I'm long vol all the time. All I can tell you is you may not make as much or you make more, but no matter what, you're not going to not pay off. So that's the whole kind of crux of it. That was a lot I just shared with you. So I'm going to now turn it back to you, ask if you have any questions or follow-ups.
Well, I want to summarize that and make sure I got it straight. So what I'm hearing here is my real premise question was, wait a minute, it seems to me like long vol is an insurance product that I would expect to pay for. How the heck is it possible that I could get paid for it? What you're telling me is my premise was right. Long vol in its purest form is an insurance policy, and it is inherently negative carry unto itself. what the other guys are doing in this long vol space is they're making money with another strategy. They're overlaying what may actually be a short vol strategy on top of their long vol strategy, and they're making enough money to pay for that long vol so that they end up not posting a negative carry, a negative return at the end of a month when nothing goes wrong. It sounds like what you're saying is you do essentially the same thing, but rather than taking risk in order to overcome that inherently negative carry of the long vol position, what you do is trade around a portfolio of long vol positions, and you use your trading skill to basically produce alpha that overcomes the inherent negative carry aspects of what is really a form of disaster insurance. Is that a fair summary?
That's a very fair summary, very, very well summarized. And with one minor revision is, to me, the difference is we all take risk. The big bifurcation is taking counterthesis risk, which is having some short vol to pay for your long vol, versus taking prothesis risk. Like, what is your thesis long vol? So if you have some short vol in your book, literally selling options in your portfolio, well then, or relative value spreads, well then you have a counterthesis position in your book versus the prothesis that everything you do is long vol and supports that thesis. That bifurcates the world to me of the one side versus the other.
So for somebody who wants, because we have a lot of very sophisticated traders who are doing their own trading, we also have a lot of family offices that are constructing portfolios and using funds like yours. For the people that are trading themselves, it sounds like the question of, okay, what's the magic secret sauce that makes it possible to show a positive carry on a pure long vol strategy? The answer is it's impossible. That doesn't happen. What people who appear to be delivering that are really doing is they have a long vol strategy and they overlay it with some kind of risk-taking strategy. And if you want to do the same thing, you got to decide which risk-taking strategy, including trading around positions, which is your risk trading strategy or risk-taking modality. People have got to take some kind of risk in order to pay for what inherently has a negative carry. That's a fair statement, correct?
Absolutely. And I would actually step out what you said further to the entire world of investing. I mean, there is no free lunch. Like, let's just call it what it is, right? You cannot make money without taking some form of risk. And anybody who says they can, it just doesn't know what their risk is yet, right? So any form of upside has some downside exposure. That's what we all do. That's what we all know. That's the world we live in. And going back to all the different arbitrage strategies, they all have a really nice consistent payoff. Mean reversion is great. So you find something cheap, you sell something expensive, and it reverts and comes back together, and you make your dollar. Every once in a while, there's a blow up and an expansion event that causes things to go out of whack and hence the negative skew. That is the risk of those strategies. So we all accept risk for upside. That's a given. In the world of long volatility investing, there, once again, to your point, to my point, there has to be risk. There cannot be. So now you say, what type of risk do I want to take to get my long vol? Because it's impossible to have pure long vol naively and have it be positive carry. That's impossible. That's not the way the world works, quote, right? So once you're taking risk, now your decision is what type of risk does one want to take? And my big position is take risk, sure, but don't take counterthesis risk. Take risk that fits alongside what you're doing. In my version, it was probabilistic risk around the magnitude of payoff. That, to me, is a very acceptable risk for having long vol exposure.
Wayne, let's talk more about how people who want to protect portfolios can go about doing that. Obviously, one option is to employ a fund manager like yourself to invest through a long volatility fund as a hedge. It sounds like the most important due diligence question to ask is, okay, we know you're taking some kind of risk in order to pull this off with a positive carry. So what kind of risk are you taking? In the case of someone who's doing their own trading, they've really got to decide what kind of risk is consistent with their portfolio. Now, when you talk about trading around these positions, are we talking about putting on a certain number of straddles and then taking off a certain number of straddles, or are we talking about legging into those straddles because you have a directional view on where the market is trading when you put the first half of a position on? What kind of trading strategies do you use in order to accomplish this?
That's a wonderful question. So the answer is that, I guess it for us, we have to, once again, going back to not even for us, let's go back to what you and I were just talking about, is one has to take risks somewhere, right? So where's the risk you're taking? The risk I'm comfortable taking, I would say, is in the middle of the distribution. When I say the middle of the distribution, it would be helpful to look at page 19 of the presentation. So start with a distribution on top, and this is a simple normal distribution, which is not the way most strategies look, but this is just for illustration or example purposes, keeping it very simple. We call it redistributing the risk, and this is the point, right? So most strategies look like the top distribution there, is the risk is on the left, the reward's on the right, right? You have your exposure gets more and more out into the tails if there's a big event, and your reward is you make money, okay? So in a long volatility trade, the way we do it, we're long a straddle, right? A straddle, you see that picture on the left there, is a straddle. A straddle is you have an at-the-money call and an at-the-money put, which means you're effectively betting on the market going in either direction. You just want it to move a lot, right? It's a magnitude bet. You're long volatility, so you want a big move in either direction. And so, of course, the basic straddle, which is the gray dashed line you see on the left, is underwater. It's underwater right away because you're paying for either side. Let's say you pay for, just for simplicity's sake, you pay a dollar for the call and you pay a dollar for the put. So before you even begin, you've paid $2. That is every day decaying because there's a cost of owning options. It's theta. There's a decline with time, right? The time value of an option is losing per day. So as soon as you pay that $2, by a week later, that's worth $1.90, just for argument's sake. So now you have this cost of ownership, we'll call it, that you have to not only beat, but you have to overcome, like, with some alpha. So our job at Logica is, I'll call it very simply, raising the straddle. And we say that above this illustration. Raising the straddle is generating alpha that is simply paying for that cost of ownership. That's all we're trying to do, is make that $2, right? And if we can make it much smaller, we have that blue V. And what we call the holy grail is that gold dash V up above, which is literally a positive carry straddle, right? You make money if the market goes up. You make money if the market goes down. The more it goes up or down, the more you make. And you make money while you wait, right? That is of course the holy grail. We all want to do that. That's what we try for. And our straddle falls somewhere in between. So now the question is, in falling somewhere between, back to what you're asking, is where's the risk taken? So that what this translates is, looking over to the right on this page, is a straddle turns the top distribution, which is the very typical distribution associated with any time series of most strategies out in the world, right? Most investment strategies look like the top one, except for a slightly different shape. But the risk on the left, the reward on the right is the big point. Now you move down to a straddle. You get the distribution below, which is saying, this is really interesting, because by being long calls and puts, you are long the left and the right tail. Right? So you make a lot of money if the market goes up a lot, and you make a lot of money if the market goes down a lot. Your risk is in the middle, right? That's the $2. That's the cost of ownership. So what we have done really by owning a straddle is redistributing the risk to the middle of the distribution. You can't blow up because your left tail, actually your shoulder and your tail on your left is covered. And on the right side, you're covered because you're long calls. So you're going to go up with the market. So you have some risk in the middle, which is your cost of ownership. Now we get to how wide we allow that band to be, right? Those black lines that I'll say are the boundaries for the risk in the middle is somewhat equivalent to, on the left side, that same color in the blue V right below the x-axis, right? That red in there, that's the risk you're taking. And so what we decide is, how much risk do we want to take there and what type of risk? Now, to your question is, we are willing to take some directional risk. And in fact, that happens naturally with the way we modulate our inventory on the straddle. So go with an example here for a second. Is, if you jump to page 12 for a moment, page 12 shows a straddle. But it shows this movement, this modulation on inventory as we move through the market. So the example I gave in the beginning of our discussion was only talking about the side of puts. Now we introduce a straddle, which is puts and calls. It's just both sides of the market. So let's go through that example. Let's say on day one, we're in 100 puts and 100 calls. So we have no directional bet and we're long vols. So we're long both tails. Okay. So now we come in and the S&P's up 1% that day, right? It's Monday or whatever. The S&P is up 1%. So we say, okay, we made a little bit of money on our calls. Let's sell a few. So we sell 10 calls, right? So now we're in 90 calls, but still our 100 puts, which have drifted a little bit away, 1% away from the money. So when we come into day two, you see that right arm is now shallower. The angle has changed because we have a lighter inventory for market upside on our calls than we do on market downside on our puts, right? So the straddle has, quote, changed shape. Now, follow that through for a few more days. Let's say day two, we sell another 10 calls, right? Market's up again. And this day three, market's up again. We sell another. You take this through for now 2 weeks later, we're only in 50 calls and still 100 puts. At this point, we're starting to lean short because we're selling our long inventory as the market's climbing. So at the same time, what happens after the market's been up for a week or two? It has some give back days. So it gives back a few points after that, or it gives back a few percent. Well, fantastic for us because we're overloaded short. So i.e. we have more puts than calls. The right arm has gotten shallower. So on the day the market gives back, now we sell or monetize some of our puts. And of course, we buy back some of the calls we sold, hopefully at a cheaper price. So what you see is happening is that because we're modulating our inventory on either side of the straddle, puts going up and down independently in number of in our size of position, calls going up and down independently in the size of the position, we are naturally going to get delta tilted any day of the week. We might be 100 puts, not 80 calls. We might be 100 calls, 80 puts. Whatever it might be, is we're in some ratio. We turn what I'll call a naive straddle, which is 100 by 100, into what we call a dynamic ratio straddle. Very simple. It's dynamic because we're modulating either side independently. It's a ratio because once we modulate it, we're going to be in some ratio of calls to puts. And it's a straddle because we're sticking to the straddle model. Okay, so if you now jump back to our page we were on before, page 19, right? So we now look at the bottom distribution again, and we see that we're by modulating that inventory, we are allowing those the black lines that set the boundary of that risk bucket is based on how much tilt we allow, right? So if I allow, going back to my prior example, 100 puts and 50 calls, I get 50% short. Well, then that boundary gets a bit wider, right? If I bring in, if I only allow my delta tilt to be 20% plus minus on either side, then that boundary gets a lot tighter, but then I can only make less money. So the decision we make based on the behavior of markets and where things are in both the S&P and volatility and volavol, we look at all these parameters or these variables that we study with our models, and we decide, number one, how much should we tilt left or right? How much should we sell or buy each day on either side of the straddle? And how wide or not should we allow this boundary of risk depending on the market's behavior? Sometimes we're in a tighter boundary and we can not generate as much alpha. Sometimes we're in a wider boundary and we can generate more alpha. These are all the decisions that our models are making to take the risk in the middle of the distribution and modulate the width of that risk. Does that all make sense or any follow-up questions?
That makes perfect sense, but help me understand the magnitude of this strategy in an overall portfolio. In other words, let's assume I'm a family office and I'm very focused on an S&P-centric investment strategy. Most of my investments are just S&P index funds. I'm using that example just because I'm assuming that that's what your data is mostly correlated against. How much, what percentage of my assets would I have to invest in a long vol strategy in order to buy enough protection, so to speak, to be covered if there's a big downside event?
That's a very hard question to answer. I think it depends on how much downside you're willing to take. Very simply, and let me expound on that, is we are generally accretive to an S&P book, right? In the sense that an S&P, or let's just look at the last 20 years, it goes up and up and up, and every once in a while it has these corrections or major sell-offs and then recovers and goes up and up and up, right? That's the market we've lived in for the last 20 years. And certainly I started in the markets in 1995 in the middle of the 90s bull market. The first correction I saw was 1998, the blow-up of long-term capital and the default of the Russian currency. So all of these things, though, that's the first, but that recovered in 3 months, right? And then so I've watched this over time where S&P climbs, has this big event, and then recovers. We all call it the V, right, in the market. And these Vs even seem to be getting more aggressive, i.e. the recoveries are even faster. Look at COVID, April or February, March of 2020. We're back in 2 months or 3 months or something ridiculous, you know, after that sell-off. So now we say, okay, so really, one could be, I mean, if we can't look at the data and say that's what the rest of the time is going to be, right? It's we can be somewhat empirical, but we don't know that that's going to always be like that, of course. We can't sample that and say it's the future. But if we look at that and let's say we assume that's the future. So now somebody says, well, really it comes down to how much do I want to cushion that downside for having an average return on the upside that's a bit less, right? But the more you cushion the downside at the same time, the more your geometric return, your compound return actually grows because more money is made by losing less than it is by making, right? So if we go to a COVID event, if you had some percentage, 10% of your portfolio in long vol, that 30% sell-off, if that 10% was enough to not be down 30, but to be, let's say, flat, right? And then the rest of the time you carry similar to the S&P because the other return is not so dilutive, then of course you're going to be the S&P but on steroids because you're the S&P without the drawdowns. That's got to be one of the greatest returns available, right? And so I don't know that does it with 10%. I mean, to answer your question is the greater the percentage, 10, 20, 30, 40, the more you're going to cushion that drawdown. So let's say the 30% drawdown in COVID, you're not going to get to flat with just a 10% allocation to something like this. It might need to be 50-50, right? But at 10%, the 30, instead of being down 30, if you're a pure S&P, maybe you're only down 15. I don't know. I don't know the exact numbers, and I can't answer that because I don't have spreadsheets in front of me. But just think of it as the more you add, the less that drawdown will be. So the more you, quote, cushion that downside. And then the rest of the time, it's not that dilutive because it's not a negative carry. It's a positive carry. So if the S&P's average year is up, let's say 8 or 9, you know, if we realistically can achieve 8 or 9 in the trading, I'm not saying we do all the time, but our alpha generating processes have the ability to generate 8 or 9 a year. Well, if they do, then we're matching the S&P in the positive times and we're cushioning it in the negative times. So you want it 50-50, right? Then you're just going to be the S&P, except it's a straight line, never with a drawdown. So I guess going back to the point is it all depends on how much groups like ours can make during the, quote, positive times or the rest of the time, not in correction phase. And then it depends on how much somebody needs to cushion those events. All of this, however, falls back on the point of us assuming that these recoveries or the V-shapes continue. If the Vs don't continue, if we get into a new world of S&P where there's a drawdown and it sits for a few years, go back to 1973, 74 bear market, things where it just kind of dwindles and it has slight run-up rallies and then gives it all back a few months later over the next few months and gets even makes lower lows. If we get into this type of market, then things like this will be even healthier or better because vol will be spiking all over the place. And especially in what we do, I'll say that I think trading a straddle and trading both sides allows us to be more favorable to swinging choppy markets because that's what effectively we're taking advantage of. So the choppier the correction, the better for us. But other people will like less choppy, a smoother, like a trailing bear market where the market's kind of just drifting down over years. That would be tougher on us, but that might be better for a relative value long vol manager like the ones we were talking about earlier because their spreads are paying off while they're waiting. So it all depends on what kind of market is our future market. This is uncertain. None of us know. And it all depends on how much somebody wants to cushion the risk. But the grand summary is that when you have a long vol approach that is accretive, all right, that has a positive carry the rest of the time, then why not have it be a major portion of your book? Why should portfolios be 99% short vol and 1% long vol? I'm a believer that, you know, whether it's us or us and a group of people, portfolios should have far more long vol in them than they currently do. You know, I mean, that multi-strat we referred to on that first slide, they should have no negative skew. If you're a multi-strat, you should not have negative skew. You should have as much long vol in your book as you do ARB and mean reversion based approaches that are short vol exposed. All right, because there's just no reason to. If they can generate similar returns in up times, then how could you not? And I guess that's the position I come from.
Well, is it really similar returns in uptimes, or is it modest returns in uptimes? I thought that the premise here was you're only trying to take enough risk to pay for those long vol exposures. So as I understand it, if you're producing a positive carry, you know, it's not like you're making 40% returns on your long vol strategy, right?
Perhaps during the meltdown of the S&P, but not the rest of the time. We're talking about the rest of the time, right?
Right, we're talking about the rest of the time. Correct. So if you have a large, if you overweight that long vol component, you're giving up performance that you could have made by involving that risk capital in some other opportunity.
So in one sense, you're giving up. So yes, you're absolutely right. Long vol books are not likely going to make 40% during, quote, the rest of the time. Like that's because what they're doing isn't really fit for that. That's not what they're trying to do. Other things can do that, right? They have the ability to. The big difference, I'll say, not necessarily disagreeing with what you're saying, but saying it from a different angle, is that that doesn't necessarily make you more over time, because the long-term accumulation of wealth, of money, is all about geometric compounding. It's all about don't lose a lot. So yeah, let's say there's 3 great years in the S&P and up 40, up 40, up 40, and whatever. Let's just say you're holding the S&P index, right? And there has been several years where it's been around 30% years. And these strategies, to your point, are not going to make 30% in years like that. Let's say they make around 10, just for an easy number, right? It's a modest return, which is the word you used. And I'll agree with that. So you're off where you have this difference of 20 for 3 years in a row, 20, 20, 20, because instead of making 30, you only made 10. And let's say there's some ratio of S&P to that long vol book. Let's say it's 50-50. So you've diluted quite a bit of your return. But now you come along to the 08 or the COVID event, that one event where that S&P book draws down 30%, right, off of your compounded number, where the other book is up 40%. Or 50% or whatever. So now suddenly you've captured 80% or that difference of spread back, right? So over the course of those 8 years that you've compounded, the returns actually might even be similar. If not, the one with a long vol book is better because you cushioned the return and it's smoother. And to boot, it's nicer to sleep at night because you don't have the exposure that's going to ever wipe you out, right? So these are the differences. I'm a strong, big, huge advocate of, if we look at the long-term compounding of returns with cushioned downside, with i.e. adding long vol in it in one's book, the long-term returns end up being quite similar. You don't get to feel the up 30% year because you feel like you're missing out that year, but it all comes back. Because the market keeps on redistributing itself. There keeps on being events that correct it, and the long-term averages play out. That's how I've seen it over at least the last 25 years.
Well, Wayne, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell us a little bit more about how people can contact Logica Funds and learn more about what you do there.
Sure. I mean, the easiest way is our website, logicafunds.com, which answers both your questions. You can read a little bit more about what we do on our website. And of course, there's a contact page or a contact link, whatever it might be. So click there and say hello, and we'll be happy to talk. We love talking about what we do and the philosophy. And we wrote a great white paper. I'll say great because we wrote it. Of course, we're biased, but it's called The Illusion of Skill, which I love people to read. It's so solid. It's really looking at the Sharpe ratio and how it misses the short vol exposure in so many different hedge fund strategies. And if you could think of it as a negative skew adjusted Sharpe ratio, right? If you adjusted Sharpe for the inherent negative skew, you look at a strategy for 3 or 4 years and it's got a Sharpe ratio of 1.3, it hasn't yet had its negative skew event. As soon as the event happens, now the Sharpe is only 1, right? And so if you had assumed that negative skew along the way, you wouldn't have thought it had a 1.3 Sharpe. You would have known it's 1.3 minus the embedded event that's about to happen or will unrealized event that's going to happen. And therefore, you have to adjust Sharpe with that in mind based on what the strategy, how it behaves. So that we call the skill metric, which is really the pure return outside of adjusting for this short vol exposure that's really so widely embedded in everything. And so we're back to the website. Would love people to download and read that. It's informative, and it really gives you a new way to think about strategies and what your exposures are.
And again, that white paper, The Illusion of Skill, is available for free at logicafunds.com. Wayne, thanks so much. We look forward to getting you back on the program for an update in a few months. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Wayne on the show. You know, I absolutely loved talking about options and long volatility strategies, and he really got my hamster wheel turning, and I'm looking forward to kind of taking a deeper dive into some of these long vol strategies out there in a second. What did you take away from the interview?
You know, I thought the really important point was I have been kind of musing on this question ever since we interviewed Chris Cole a few years ago. What's up with these guys that are running these long vol funds where the premise is that you can get the insurance benefit of hedging, of protection against downside, but you don't have to pay for it? You know, wait a minute. That doesn't seem like it's really straight. Well, what's really going on with these funds that claim to do this, at least what I feel was revealed in today's interview, is it really is an insurance product. It costs money to put that protection on. It always has a negative carry when you're buying protection. What they're doing is they're also trading in these funds in order to make enough alpha to pay for that protection. So it's not really a hedge that pays for itself. It's a hedge that costs money plus some other kind of strategy which allows you to get that hedge effectively for free, but you're still taking the risk of whatever that other strategy is blowing up somehow and losing money. So it clarified this whole situation for me. I want to get into your chart deck though, because we're going to talk about some specific trades that actually implement these concepts. So let's move on to the chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. Now, if you don't have a research roundup email in your inbox, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. So just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, page 2 in the chart deck is the S&P 500 continuous futures chart. What's going on here other than up, up, up?
Well, that's exactly it, right? Well, I just wanted to give our listeners a quick update on what's going on in the markets. I had some upper targets measuring out to about this 4550 to 4600. So we're slowly approaching what I would call the upper boundary of the short-term targets. That doesn't in itself guarantee that there's some sort of big scary correction. Every time we seem to have these corrections, they last about 2-3 days, pull back, you know, a couple percent, find support on some moving averages, and they just become buy on dip opportunities. And I don't know if there's any immediate catalyst other than more volume coming back into the markets. One way or another, it'll be a really interesting tell what will happen come post Labor Day, because that's really, again, when the volume comes back in, and it'll be interesting to see how traders commit to new trends and whether that will be a transition point for that. Nonetheless, on page three, though, I had the crude oil chart, and I really wanted to kind of highlight that real breakout we got today, and also get your take on this as well. Like, one of the things that we were talking about back in August was I just thought there was room for a very robust rally to happen from November to July to have a correction, and that's exactly what we got. We got that, you know, pullback from 75 to down towards $60 to where there was substantial support through March and May. But what was really surprising to me is just the magnitude of the snapback rally after that correction. It just started with huge velocity, and it seems to continue. And it really does feel like the bulls are going to give this a shot to the upside. What I think really I'm using as a pivot is whether or not the bulls can hold 70. I mean, it really below $70, we'd have to always still entertain the idea that there could be another squiggle to retest that August low. But the 70 breakout might set things in motion. What are you watching on this chart?
Well, I think we're at a critical resistance level right now. As you can see, there's kind of a channel that was forming, a downsloping channel, and we're right at the top of the channel, right on the line about to break out of it. It's not on this chart, but the continuation 55-day moving average, as well as the 200-month moving average, are also right there where the market is right now, around 70 spot 50. And just above it, at 70 spot 88, we've got the 13-week moving average. If we can get past that, that's kind of the last of the resistance that I see. And I think it's clear sailing from there back up to the previous high, and then from there up into the 80s. It could be that we're about to see a reversal to the downside here. We are right at the critical resistance, just like I said on gold. But I've got a feeling that this has already shaken itself out. There's really no fundamental driver for negative prices here, other than August didn't go down the way everybody thought it was going to go down. The other side of it, which is the worsening COVID situation, yeah, that's true. But I think that we're going to run the economy through the worsening COVID situation. There's still going to be demand. So I think that we're probably seeing the beginning of the recovery. You're right, there could be one more, you know, wave down. We could get a test of 59 just to, you know, break through that round number support at 60 to see what happens. But I'll be surprised if we even get that. I think it's probably the worst is behind us.
All right. Well, I wanted to jump on page four to actually one of the energy markets that is running pretty hot, and that's the natural gas market. And we really have seen a breakout, and it is very reminiscent of 2018 when there was the last little kind of mini melt up in nat gas prices. Didn't sustain that much, but really seems to be accelerating to the upside. It feels almost a little bit like a lumber chart on there. I'm curious whether or not nat gas is going to be able to clear the $5 level on the upside, but clearly this is a hot market now, and it'll be really interesting to see whether or not bulls can follow through on this.
Let's move on to page five, Patrick, and take a look at uranium. What's happening here?
Well, it's interesting because that uranium participation fund, there was a lot of hype when it got converted into the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. And what's interesting is that after all the hype, it spent a couple weeks backfilling and correcting downward, stuck in a range. But uranium suddenly has woken up this past week, and a pretty legitimate breakout attempt on the upside, breaking out of what was basically almost a six-month sideways range. And so it'll be really interesting to see whether or not uranium has just started a brand new bull run on the upside. I always say one day doesn't make a new trend. And I don't want to already be like touting that this is going to autopilot to $20, but it is interesting that the range is broken out to the upside, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not the bulls dig in and really start to establish a sustaining trend on the upside and really set in motion a lot of those uranium stocks, which have corrected quite a bit over the last over the summer months.
Patrick, from what I'm reading, a lot of this demand is because of the Sprott Uranium Trust. Sprott's marketing is bringing a lot of interest into it. Let's move on, though, to the main subject of today's postgame segment, which is long volatility option strategies. You heard Wayne in the feature interview allude to a lot of these concepts. Let's get into the nitty-gritty of how this works.
Right. You know, I found it really interesting the way he kind of tried to differentiate himself from not only other long vol funds, but other strategies in general, and just like how he manages his long volatility fund. But, you know, to me, one has to put into context, though, that when you start a fund to be long volatility or short volatility through an income writing or something like that, you basically have a mandate to invest that way. And you're always looking for ways to be, in the case of Wayne's situation, long tail risk and long volatility and profit from that. My philosophy is slightly more dynamic because we're not a fund. You don't always have to be long volatility or short volatility. There's strategic and tactical times to deploy the strategies. So I kind of step back and look at the markets through cycles, and the idea that there's periods of stability and periods of instability. You know, on page 7, I have that chart of the weekly chart of the S&P 500, and you kind of keep talking about this Austrian melt-up boom. But when I see this chart, I think we've been in the midst of it for quite a while. It really looks like we've started to run quite parabolic on this market. And the way I kind of look at the market where we are today is to describe the period of stability versus instability. I like to use the analogy to visualize like a Jenga tower, like that game. And the game starts from a stable structure, and as the game progresses, the tower gets taller, but the base becomes more unstable, and inevitably the tower falls. And so when applied to the markets, you go through this period of stability where the market is either consolidating for long periods of time or has just ended a market correction, and then it proceeds to run into a bull market phase, and as it's rising higher and higher, it becomes more and more unstable, inevitably until a market correction resets the market back to a stable state. And so I kind of look at this today where we're at, and we are now exactly 1 year. It was September 2nd, 2020. A year ago to the day that we had our last 10% market correction. And we are 530 days in a rally off the COVID lows back in March 2020, where the market is up over 100% off of the lows from that time period. And inevitably, the market rally is going to be checked. And this is not about calling for a new bear market or some devastating market crash, but markets work in cycles. And inevitably, this leg of the rally is getting long in the tooth. As an example, Eric, if you go back to using like the 2009 period at the end of the financial crisis, there were two 20% market corrections that followed in the year 2010 and 2011, even though we were in the midst of a new bull market. And so I think that at some stage here, we're going to end up seeing some sort of a market correction that is going to check this rally. And so it makes it really interesting to use one of these long volatility strategies to kind of reduce the overall volatility in your portfolio. But the interesting part about Wayne's interview is when you're long volatility and you're buying, let's say, strategies that are going to give you huge payoffs on the tail, one of the interesting elements is that, well, what if this is just a 20% correction but not a devastating market crash? What if it's like when you're building a strategy such as a back spread, let's say a put back spread, your real payoff is on that, you know, 2 to 4 standard deviation move to the downside, where the market is really blowing out, almost like the crash during the COVID, that really that kind of a strategy pays off. But like Wayne was suggesting, there are situations with strategies like that where, you know, if the stock market only ends up being down 10%, you might actually be not only down on the market on your positions, but you might actually even be down on your long vol strategy, and it didn't actually provide a hedge because it wasn't a deep enough of a market drop. So I wanted to kind of put some context into the different ways of being long volatility and what investors or our listeners can consider when kind of trying to hedge out some of these different risks.
Patrick, you mentioned the back spread strategy. Let's take a look on page 8 at how that works.
Right. And so put-back spread is a typical strategy utilized by the selling. So if you recall when Wayne was saying that infuses a short vol in order to pay for buying all of the long vol. And sometimes that can be calendared, that can be done at different strikes. But in its simplest form, you are selling, let's say, one at the money put for a very large and juicy put premium, and then using the proceeds to buy many more puts that are farther out of the money with the proceeds. And the idea that you're buying all this long gamma below the lower strike. And so if you notice here on this chart, let's say we were looking at that put spread there on the left there, Eric, what you can see is that your point of actual loss, so let's say the starting point is $50 there, your actual point of greatest loss at expiry is actually at the $45 mark, or roughly 10% lower than the market where it is. So in other words, you would need almost over a 20% market correction in this example that's illustrated here for that left tail payoff of the long volatility strategy to really start to kick in and make big money. And that's perfectly fine. But usually if you're deploying one of these very low cost carry back spreads, one has to recognize that you're really looking for a big outlier move. And it's going to do a very good job hedging a really big crash if that was what's happening. But if let's say you're right now listening to this and you're worried about a 10 to 20% market correction, odds are that the back spread will disappoint you in terms of your payoff. What makes it even worse is the fact that the S&P 500 or many beta 1 kind of securities have a left tail skew in the vol premiums. And therefore, as you're going farther out of the money, those out of the money puts are being priced at higher and higher implieds, making you have to widen the spread even farther in order to make even, let's say, a 2-to-1 ratio on the back spread. And so the only thing I wanted to highlight here, there's nothing wrong with this strategy, but it may not be the right fit if you're just simply trying to hedge out that kind of 10 to 20% market drop.
Okay, so the back spread, which some people call a ratio spread, really the lesson to pay attention to here is it only really works if you have conviction about a really big event happening, a really big outlier event happening. What if we don't have that expectation of the big outlier? What strategies can we look at that maybe have better characteristics?
Well, this is where we can highlight the long straddle and long strangle strategies that Wayne talked about. Now, what was really interesting about Wayne's approach is that through the fact that they are active traders and they're very good at what they do and they're sitting at the machine and have some sort of a process from which they are kind of adding and taking away positions to dynamically try to create alpha to pay for the fact that they're long a straddle. And that's a great way to approach it, but it's not an easy way for an average investor to approach it. Ultimately, when you're long a straddle, you're long obviously vega or long volatility on both ends, but you're starting pretty much at a very neutral stage, and you also need a relatively larger move for these things to start legitimately paying off. But like we've talked about on many past Macro Voice sessions, this comes at the cost of quite a heavy carry. I mean, you're a theta burning on both a call and a put, and you have to find some way of actually getting a reasonable payoff in order to justify having carried that. And this is where, you know, we're using all sorts of different ideas and strategies for how to deploy this. One of my favorite is an actively managed spread, which is something that we have currently going on in our portfolio. And I think it's a more tactical way to hedge out the most immediate downside risk of a market correction and able to still mitigate some of the carry cost associated with it. And so there are all sorts of really neat strategies, and I'm looking forward to actually taking our listeners through some of them in a live webinar.
And listeners, you can get Patrick's chart decks and webinars every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading, which you can find information on at page 10. But Patrick, you mentioned you're doing a specific webinar about these volatility strategies. When is that happening? What do your members have to do in order to get signed up for it? And for people who are not members, will they be able to watch that one with the free trial membership that's available for free at BigPictureTrading.com?
Now, you said exactly right, Eric, which is all of my existing members, as well as anyone who signs up for the free trial, can get access to this webinar for free. We're going to be hosting it on Thursday, September the 16th at 4 p.m. Eastern time. But those that can't attend it live, the recording will be made available immediately afterwards and sent to everyone's inboxes. So anyone who wants to see us review the pros and cons of each of these long vol strategies with real simulators and looking at the live markets as to what they are and how I think one can approach adding hedges into their portfolio, then come join us for a trial and see what it's all about.
And that's on September 16th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the slide deck provided by Wayne and the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to a Variant Perception article on the crude oil recovery and a great interview by Morris Sachs interviewing Kevin Muir. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.